Hello, my name is Jacob Bloomfield, and I'm a Zukunftskolleg postdoctoral fellow at the University of Konstanz. It's my pleasure to introduce today's talk by Professor Eric Lott, entitled Marx in Texas, Slavery, Capital, and the Revolutionary 1860s. I heard also a few alternative titles for this, including Pardoners and Proletarians, that was my friend, and I suggested Stetsons and Socialism, which I don't think is as good, but. Eric Lott is a distinguished professor of English at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City, and for the next 2 months, a Zukunftskolleg fellow at the University of Konstanz. Before arriving at CUNY, Professor Lott received his PhD in English from Columbia University and taught at the University of Virginia. Professor Lott's expertise covers a wide range of disciplines, including cultural history, literature, and African American studies. His impressive oeuvre includes 3 books, such as the landmark 1993 text, Love and Theft, Blackface Minstrelsy and the American Working Class. Published by Oxford University Press, Love and Theft analyzes the cultural ubiquity of blackface minstrelsy in antebellum America and identifies the reasons for the cultural form's profound appeal for practitioners and audiences. Professor Lott's most recent book, Black Mirror, The Cultural Contradictions of American Racism, published by Harvard University Press in 2017, discusses how the white observer has engaged with representations of blackness in popular culture from the times of slavery in the US to the present day. We'll have the pleasure of hearing about his new research with today's talk, Marx in Texas. The talk illuminates the overlooked history of how the US Civil War and American debates over slavery influenced Karl Marx's Das Kapital. And without further ado, here's Professor Eric Lott with Marx in Texas.
Thank you very much, Jacob. And I'm very happy to, delighted in fact, to be here and to see all of you. And those of you I cannot see out there in Zoom land, but hello. And thank you for attending. This work is germinal. It's an idea I've had for some time and started to work on over the last few years, trying to see what connections I could find between a period of interest of mine, the middle decades of the 19th century, 1800s in the United States, and revolutionary developments on the European continent, and Karl Marx, and Marx's work in particular. And I got extremely interested in looking at Capital Volume 1, Das Kapital, the only volume of Capital published in Marx's lifetime, on the 50th reading, noticing all the references to US cotton slave systems, US slavery in the book, and wanted to investigate that further, because I think that even though Marx doesn't address slavery as directly as he might, slavery in odd forms that I'm going to try and talk about appears very consistently, as does the United States as such, all through the volume. So I'm going to tell some stories about these connections. If I can, for a little while, and I won't go on too long. And I'm going to read, for which I apologize, so that it will be as streamlined as I can possibly make it. But first, there are several kind of contexts that I'll name quickly for this work. One is Marx has never gone out of style, but particularly over the last decade, there's been a resurgence of interest in the Anglo-speaking world, the Anglo-American world, on the part of noted Marxists, aging Marxists, such as Terry Eagleton, Frederick Jameson, Eric Hobsbawm, Robin Blackburn, and several others who published work on Marx, all of which reanimates and revives interest in Marx without, however, addressing the context that I'd like to address, this U.S. connection. There is also a second context is the new work on U.S. slavery and slave society that has sought to attach the slavery system so long thought separate from Northern U.S. capitalism back into a capitalist world system. The work of Walter Johnson, Sven Becker, Edward Baptist, and several others, Stephen Hahn. A third context is, in the U.S. particularly, the notion of late last several years has become a very hot topic of so-called racial capitalism. And it's the understanding of capitalism and left work resisting it and against it as a racial as well as class and commodity and capital system. This is the work of Cedric Robinson, David Roediger, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Robin Kelly, and many others. Finally and lastly, there's the context of, and this is particularly an activist context on the left, and an electoral one too, that surfaced in the 2016 election between those who emphasize race and those who emphasize class. It was widely seen to be the case that Bernie Sanders came in on the class side and Hillary Clinton very much on the race side, although there were, that was more complicated than it was painted to be. And so the choice on the Democratic left, electorally speaking, between certain kinds of racial urgencies and certain kinds of class urgencies. This talk tries to intervene in all of those contexts and draw from them, as you will see. I have two epigraphs. One is from Marx himself. In fact, this is from Capital, Volume 1. In fact, the veiled slavery of the wage laborers in Europe needed the unqualified slavery of the New World as its pedestal. That's one. Second one is from Peter Linebaugh, American historian, and his book, The Magna Carta Manifesto. The important difference between English and American constitutional development is not that one is unwritten and the other is written. The difference is Africa. So this is Marx. I start with Marx. Things are taking a revolutionary turn, wrote Marx in August of 1862. Lincoln knows what Europe does not know. New England and the Northwest, which had supplied the main body of new recruits, are determined to force on the government a revolutionary waging of the war and to inscribe the Star-Spangled Banner, to inscribe on it the battle slogan, abolition of slavery. And those of you who know that Marx wrote all through the 1860s about US developments and the Civil War in particular. The slaveholders, continues Marx, will yield only to force. Up to now, we have witnessed only the first act of the Civil War, the constitutional waging of war. The second act, the revolutionary waging of war, is at hand, unquote. For Marx, the American Civil War was nothing less than world transforming, as he put it in a letter to Friedrich Engels later that year. Here at a stroke was a whole race losing its chains and an entire planter class divested of its human property, a decisive turn in the history of the world proletariat. While we know that the slavery question for Lincoln was less urgent than the maintenance of the Union, Lincoln famously said at a certain point early in the war and before the war, that he would preserve the Union with slavery or without it. That effort, the Civil War, that effort's byproduct, emancipation, raised him to world historical stature in Marx's eyes. The capitalist consolidation that Marx knew would be one result of emancipation was a secondary matter, or was, in another sense, crucial to the US's emergence from its contradictory economic foundation. Marx and like-minded thinkers and activists around him in London, because by this time Marx is, for the rest of his life, in London, were so galvanized by these prospects that one of the very first actions undertaken by the International Working Men's Association, or First International, upon its founding in the fall of 1864, was to write to Lincoln congratulating him on his recent re-election. Marx drafted the brief address in English, concluding, quote, "The working men of Europe feel sure that as the American War of Independence initiated a new era of ascendancy for the middle class, so the American anti-slavery war will do for the working classes. They consider it an earnest or pledge of the epoch to come that it fell to the lot of Abraham Lincoln, the single-minded son of the working class," a fine phrase, "to lead his country through the matchless struggle for the rescue of an enchained race and the reconstruction of a social world, unquote. Not only was the great emancipator an American revolutionary, the revolutionary events in the US were at the forefront of social progress in the Anglophone world. For his part, though, Lincoln refused the revolutionary posture and rhetoric that had come so readily to him earlier in his political career. He'd made a lot out of that rhetoric in his rise to power. For him, the only thing revolutionary about the sectional conflict was the South's intention to establish its own government. Indeed, much of his public speaking time during the war was spent denying the right of a minority to make a revolution. Lincoln was a classic exceptionalist, so-called. If the great modern nation-states of Europe had come into being with a series of revolutionary uprisings, 1789, 1848, and so on, the United States would advance, he believed, precisely by forestalling any further insurrections. The kind of revolutionary developments that had called his own country into being had now to be denounced as rebellious, unjustified, and illegal. For some observers, this seemed a bit rich from a political leader who had based his career on routine invocations of the revolutionary founders, those heralds of a new political mission, framers of the almost literally sacred Declaration of Independence. Lincoln, the former Whig, had said in that watershed year, 1848, that, quote, any people anywhere, being inclined and having the power, have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable, a most sacred right, a right which we hope and believe is to liberate the world, unquote. This was concerning the war with Mexico, which is 1846 to 1848. Where the US stole a bunch of territory from Mexico, which, like most Whigs, Lincoln opposed because it overextended into properly Mexican territory, the legitimate revolution, as Lincoln saw it, that had established the state of Texas, itself carved out of Mexican territory in 1835 by settlers, but made a state in 1845. That was fine, according to Lincoln and other Whigs. Texas was, for Lincoln, the revolutionary test case. Said Lincoln, any portion of such people that can may revolutionize and make their own of so much of the territory as they inhabit. And I guess the distinction there for Lincoln is that since white United Statesians were already there for some time, since at least 1835, they could take it. The distinction, if it's unclear to you, it's unclear to me too. Lincoln goes, it is a quality of revolutions not to go by old lines or old laws, but to break up both and make new ones, unquote. The bitter pill the South was made to swallow consisted in the fact that the right to revolution in both 1776 and 1861 was conferred by the Northern bourgeoisie. The American Revolution was a glorious libertarian triumph. Southern secession, a counter-revolutionary offensive by what one activist, Wendell Phillips, termed a rebellious aristocracy. For Lincoln was now overseeing a different kind of revolution, a capitalist one, brokering on behalf of the Northern interests, Marx cites, a solidified entrepreneurial capitalism in the economic and moral philosophy summed up in the well-known Republican Party slogan, itself a new party, founded in 1854, the slogan, free soil, free labor, and free men. All of those terms, incredibly ambiguous to folks like us now, I think. We can talk about that. If in Marx's self-conscious vocabulary of the theater, the first act of the war was constitutional, involving so many bargaining maneuvers of a legislative kind, to bring a slave sector under Northern hegemony, the second act was revolutionary, as Marx says, because the use of force and state-mandated emancipation as of 1863, augured what Barrington Moore Jr. once called the last revolutionary offensive on the part of what one may legitimately call urban or bourgeois capitalist democracy. I begin with this series of connections to provide a context for my main points of interest here, the importance of the revolutionary American 1860s to Marx's great work in that decade, not least his extensive analyses of US affairs. He's very much paying attention to those affairs. as well as, and above all, the status of slave labor and Southern slave society in Capital, Volume 1, Das Kapital, including the textual or literary figurations that conjoin and mediate these matters. I once tried to bring these together by way of the text Marx composed a decade earlier, the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, first published not over here, but in Lower Manhattan, by Marx's friend Josef Wedemeyer in a German language socialist publication, Die Revolution, in 1852. The 18th Brumaire of Abraham Lincoln, I called it. And I argue that Marx's work offers an excellent contemporaneous gloss on Lincoln's rhetorical maneuvers in the face of a mighty contradiction between the American Revolution's hold over America's post-heroic generation, so-called, the rousing nationalist usefulness of the mythology of a colonial break from tyranny, and the prospect of national continuance in its confrontation with the secessionist challenge. You may remember that Marx in the 18th Brumaire talks about revolutionaries anxiously, this is Marx, anxiously conjuring up the spirits of the past to their service and borrowing from them names, battle cries, and costumes in order to present the new scene of world history in this time-honored disguise and this borrowed language. So Luther donning the mask of the Apostle Paul, the revolution of 1789 to 1814 using the drapery of the Roman Republic, and so on. And I claim in this article of a while back that like the beginner learning a new language that Marx describes there, Lincoln learned a new language, no longer celebrating the 1776 revolutionaries in the heat of civil war. By early 1865, just as the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery was being passed by the House of Representatives, as it had earlier passed in the Senate, Lincoln was happy to accept Marx and the First International's congratulations, quote, with a sincere and anxious desire that he may be able to prove himself not unworthy of the confidence which has recently been extended to him by his fellow citizens and by so many of the friends of humanity and progress throughout the world, notably the enlightened approval and earnest sympathies of the working men of Europe. Now, Lincoln sent this little note back to Marx and the First International by way of an ambassadorial mediator. But still, it's quite tantalizing to have Lincoln and Marx being pen pals. If Marx glosses Lincoln so well, it's perhaps because US struggles had already come to inform his own conceptual work. Capital, Das Kapital, is one of the Victorian period's great cognitive maps. Cousin German of Dickens's Our Mutual Friend as much as Darwin's Origin of Species. It's 800 plus pages, developed, of course, out of German post-Hegelian philosophy and French socialist thought, but in a quite immediate context of British political economy and sociology, absorbed through almost 20 years by then, 1849 forward till 1867, of living and researching in London itself, at the British Museum, of course, which is to say a context unavoidably colored by American realities and the fantasies to which they gave rise. Anglo-American circuits of labor and capital were particularly closely articulated, evidenced in Engels's own life from around the time he began to collaborate with Marx in the middle 1840s. Representing the British branch of the family textile firm of Ehrman and Engels in Manchester, so Fred's in Manchester, where he would write his brilliant path-breaking study, The Condition of the Working Class in England in 1844, which comes out in 1845, which very much influenced Marx. Engels oversaw the processing of American cotton from the slave states into sewing thread, very often sending a portion of the proceeds to the perennially destitute Marx, who didn't have a job, who toiled over his researches in his favorite chair in the British Museum, and in the 1850s, mostly sustained the family income with journalistic articles on world affairs for Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. So he's writing for an American newspaper to an American audience to make a little bread on the side. How could Marx and Engels not have been influenced by US affairs? Marx was literally, partially anyway, living off of slavery's residuals. At the same time, he counseled his friend Weidemeyer to emigrate to New York, which Weidemeyer did, founding publications, moving from city to city, like lots of Germans, 48ers in that period, eventually distinguishing himself as an officer in the Union Army. One can only dream about what might have happened if Marx had chosen a similar course. He almost did. We should note, as biographers and scholars seldom do, or when they do, note it only in passing, that in 1845, when Marx was 27, in the thick of his early work, he's written the Paris manuscripts by then, 1844, economic and philosophical manuscripts, various titles, as well as the German ideology, the Holy Family, and other stuff co-produced with Engels at that point. Marx became interested in emigrating to the United States. He really thought about coming to the US. Because of his radical activities, he was being chased by the authorities from one European capital to the next, Cologne to Paris to Brussels to Paris, back to Cologne. By 1849, he had wound up in London, where he would remain for the rest of his life, 34 years, dying there in 1883. In 1845, he wrote to the Oberbürgermeister of his hometown of Trier for an emigration certificate to the US. Where did he want to go? The brand new state of Texas. So he claimed. Mm-hmm. Texas, really. Mm-hmm. Settler colonial country. Lincoln's somewhat specious revolutionary territory, where it was okay to be a revolutionary, and a slave state. That's interesting to me. Marx would remain interested in questions of popular land acquisition, US land reform, and emigration to North America, all the way to the final page of Capital Volume 1, if you look at it, more than 20 years later, 1867, if not indeed longer than that. Here's a remark from the final page of Capital Volume 1. Quote, "The American Civil War has brought in its train a colossal national debt, and with it a heavy tax burden, the creation of a finance aristocracy of the vilest type, and the granting of immense tracts of public land to speculative companies for the exploitation of railways, mines, etc. In short, it has brought a very rapid centralization of capital. The Great Republic has therefore ceased to be the promised land for emigrating workers," kind of a forlorn passage there. And I think he's thinking of his own dreams of emigrating once upon a time, 20 years, 22 years earlier. At any rate, all this for me raises the specter of an American Marx. I'm not taking him away from you or anything. But this intersection is interesting to me. And I would like to briefly explore the way US conceptions of labor, slave and free, politics, territory, and more suffuse Marx's complex, evolving, and contradictory figurations of wage work, capitalism, modes of production, and revolution itself. In many ways, Marx's clairvoyance in Capital, in many directions, comes via reading the United States in a fashion that Pierre Macheret, literary theorist in the 1970s, a book called The Theory of Literary Production, he was an Althusserian literary theorist, once termed unspoken. Certainly, America's revolutionary 1860s stalk the plot of Marx's great Victorian masterwork. As early as 1846, Marx wrote that the US Land Reformist National Reform Association would lead in the end to an attack on land ownership altogether and drive it toward communism, quote unquote. As I hope to show, a Lone Star communism, or what'd you call it? A partner proletariat is not the strangest yoking to arise out of Marx's theoretical reflections on the nature of capital. My interest then is in addressing Marx's intensely ambiguous renderings of US revolutionary processes arising from chattel slavery in his analysis of capitalism. and Capital as such. His frequent references in Capital Volume 1 to the enslaved population of the US that nonetheless disallow that population a key role in his dramatis personae. And he's got this famous line early in Das Kapital, which claims the English example, the English model in England as the classic, being the classic example of capitalism. And it's like it's a subordinate clause, it's a passing clause. Since we all know England is the classic example, I'm gonna focus on England, he says. A rather provincial focus, I would claim. Since already, even doing that, you have to take in a whole world system. Anyway, we've long been aware of Capital's gothic tropes, its werewolves and life-sucking vampires, the manifestos, communist manifestos, specters and clanking chains, specter is haunting Europe, beyond which lies the deployment everywhere in Marx's work of classical mythology, the mechanics of theater, the polarities of melodrama. Slavery enters the text of Capital in this somewhat uncertain register, suspended somewhere between analogy and outright social fact. Part of my project is indeed to investigate the conceptual valence of Marx's incorrigible resort to the tropological value of slave labor. I won't belabor the ways in which Marx punned and made metaphorical use of slavery, even in everyday life. He called his books his slaves. His son-in-law, Paul Lafargue, famous anarchist, said, "Why do you treat your books so badly? They're all bent up and torn and, you know, marking them." He said, "They're my slaves. They're all dog-eared. You know, they serve my will," he said. Also, Marx's nickname, we often forget, was Moor, as in Othello, M-O-O-R, Moor, because he was dark of hue. All his friends called him not Marx, not Karl, but Moor. The correspondence, if you look at it, are often addressed simply Moor, dash, and they go on, and the letter follows. So that's interesting too. Marx is black. Was Marx black? The way in which, you could continue this metaphorical meditation with the way in which he uses citation as a kind of exchange value, almost. The degree to which Capital Volume 1 is built out of quoting other people. I don't know if somebody must have counted the volume of Capital Volume 1 that is actually extracted from other writers. Either the factory inspectors in England who wrote the so-called blue books, the regulatory blue books, who reported on the safety conditions of the factories, to political economy, Ricardo in France or Smith in England, other writers of all kinds, journalists, newspapers. So there's a kind of extractive exchange value going on, even in Marx's own work. But let me move on to the case itself, the status of slavery in Das Kapital. It goes like this. Marx followed the progress of the American Civil War closely and wrote about it extensively for the New York Tribune and also the Viennese paper, Depressive. Too few have recognized that the war and Marx's dispatches not only coincide with, but also enter quite broadly into the composition and text of Capital Volume 1, published shortly after the war's conclusion in 1867. Marx's enthusiasm for Lincoln and his role in world history make for compelling enlargements of Marx's notions of revolution. By the same token, exploring the impact slavery and its revolutionary overthrow in the 1860s in the United States. We don't often think of the Civil War as a revolution, but that it was. The impact of all those events on Marx's evolving views of labor and political economy brings an understudied dimension of Capital Volume 1 to our understanding. At many points in the work, Marx calls on analogies with US slavery to depict the situation of the wage worker, nothing but a slave, and the working day. These references are so insistent and suggestive as to raise questions about Marx's stance regarding the precise relation of slavery to the English capitalism he rather willfully calls the classical form demanding study. Marx certainly demystifies the notion of free labor, like you don't have to work for that person, you can work for that person, so you're nominally free. Marx demystifies this because you got to sell your labor to somebody in order to have bread and a roof over your head. Marx certainly demystifies the notion of free labor through broad comparisons of it to chattel slavery. But in doing so, he muddies the issue of whether a slave economy proper exists within or beyond the conceptual bounds of capitalism. Is it a whole other system, or is it locked into capitalism? The questions that arise and that interest me are these. How can slavery be both an analogy for wage work and its necessary buttress, not only in the US, but in Great Britain as well, fundamental as it was in the form of the cotton trade to the textile industry in manufacturing towns like Manchester? Is slavery, for Marx, capitalism's other, a ready metaphor, or its handmaiden lodged somewhere near its heart? Is slavery in the end a sort of animating specter of a tome from which it has been exiled? Or is slavery itself a constituent part of Marx's very subject? And what sort of account does he make of it? Does Capital Volume 1 render slavery, you know, completely contemporaneous with and crucial to the existence of Western capitalism? Does Marx render it prior to or outside capitalism's frame of reference, or is the relationship between the two more nuanced in Capital Volume 1? What if Marx, as historian Walter Johnson has asked, had begun his magisterial analysis of the commodity with a bale of cotton rather than a bolt of linen? Because you recall that Capital Volume 1 begins with the transformation of a bolt of linen into a coat. That's the commodity section that Capital Volume 1 begins with, Das Kapital. And we see the transformation and the becoming commodity of a coat. Marx imagines fetish commodities rendered so mystical, famously, that they rise up and talk. They talk back to you. This table talks in Das Kapital. What to make of commodities in Kentucky walking around the US enslaved who already do that? I want to not take up too much time going through the following, but I think it's crucial to note just a little bit about the composition process of Capital Volume 1 and what Marx is doing simultaneously with that, sitting there in London in the British Museum, because Capital Volume 1, Das Kapital, published in 1867, is carved out of an enormous set of manuscripts that Marx is writing in the early and mid-1860s. And I can give you more detail on this if you're interested. I won't do it now. But these manuscripts stretch to 5 volumes in the collected works. At this moment, Marx is also helping found the First International Working Men's Association. The Civil War writings that he's already done in the American Affairs criticism that he's already done in the 1850s, and the stuff, particularly in letters, that he's writing in the 1860s are really going on simultaneously in the background. And people have argued that US affairs have a kind of decisive weight on his thinking in Capital Volume 1, not least his decision to write the chapter 10 of Das Kapital called The Working Day, the famous Working Day chapter, where he simply just says, let's go into the factories and see what we see. And it's hideous, it's terrible. You know, you have children, 12 years of age, expiring, dying on the job because they've been working 20-hour days with poor ventilation and poor lighting and so forth. We happen to know that the Working Day chapter was written very late in Capital's composition in 1866, really at the 11th hour, and that events in the US seem to have influenced this. quite specifically, we have nothing from Marx on the Civil War between a letter he wrote to Engels in July of 1861 and a piece written in mid-September that year on British public opinion regarding the war. So, and that this while he was working during these months on his vast 1861 to 1863 manuscript, so that all of his energies, I mean, I think I might claim, are going, you know, thinking about war, revolutionary upheaval in the US, British events, as well as events worldwide, Polish uprising in 1863, developments in Germany, are going into this vast manuscript that he'll carve Das Kapital out of. At any rate, the importance of these events for Marx is very clear from the preface to Das Kapital. As soon as page 3 of the book, if you've looked at it lately, you notice that the United States shows up almost immediately in Das Kapital. Quote, "Just as in the 18th century, the American War of Independence sounded the tocsin or the alarm for the European middle class, so in the 19th century, the American Civil War did the same for the European working class. In England, the process of transformation is palpably evident. When it has reached a certain point, it must react on the continent." Unquote. You will recognize these lines from Marx's note to Lincoln on behalf of the First International. He just slips it right into Capital. The first of many interpolations of US reflection into the text. And the image here, quite against the grain of our intellectual habits, is of an alarm rolling not westward across the Atlantic, but from west to east, from the US to the UK to continental Europe. By 1867, a standard line of Marxist thought, as in his remark to Engels in a letter a few years earlier, this is that remark. "In my opinion, the biggest things now happening in the world are, on one hand, the American slave movement, started by the death of Brown, the insurrection at Harper's Ferry by John Brown and a bunch of vigilantes. They raided an armory and were trying to start a slave revolt. They were caught. Brown was hung in 1859, on the one hand, and the slave movement in Russia on the other. I've just seen in the Tribune, that would be the New York Tribune, that there has been a slave uprising in Missouri, naturally suppressed. But the signal has now been given. If things gradually get serious, what will become of Manchester?" There again, the course of revolutionary impulse is traveling from the US to the UK. This conceptual grafting or elision of serfdom, slavery, and wage labor reaches into many corners of Capital Volume 1. Its American dimension, I would call it. A couple of quick examples. He's trying to think slavery and wage labor at one and the same time. Oh, the first of these is not there. Let me just quote to you. "Speaking of the struggle for a normal working day," this is in the Working Day chapter, for example. He's talking about wage labor and the working day, and seemingly out of nowhere, and this happens all the time in Das Kapital, Marx remarks upon the slave owner buying the slave like someone buys a horse. He pulls a long quotation from a historian that he's quoting, who says that slaves can always be replaced. There's no interest on the plantation in prolonging their lives. Marx responds, quote, "For slave trade, read labor market. For Kentucky and Virginia, Ireland and the agricultural districts of England, Scotland and Wales. For Africa, Germany," unquote. In England, he observes, immigrants or migrants can simply replenish the thinned out ranks. Surplus populations from the agricultural districts can be brought in. It's no big deal. So the equation of the systems is very much going on. Marx quotes certain legislative commentators. "This system had grown up into a regular trade," they say. "This traffic in human flesh was as well kept up as slaves are sold to the cotton grower in the United States." So Marx, in many cases, sets up a kind of sliding scale of unfreedom from wage work to enslavement. And there's even a kind of simultaneity of modes that he incorporates in passages like this one. Again, from the Working Day chapter, chapter 10 of Das Kapital. In the United States, every independent workers' movement was paralyzed as long as slavery disfigured a part of the republic. Labor in a white skin cannot emancipate itself where it is branded in a black skin. However, a new life immediately arose in the death of slavery. The first fruit of the American Civil War was the 8 hours agitation, the struggle for an 8 hour day. Down from 12 to 10, trying to get it from 10 to 8. We take the 8 hour day, much as we hate it, for granted, but it's a historical artifact, of course. The 8 hours agitation, which ran from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from New England to California, with the seven league boots of the locomotive. The General Congress of Labor, held at Baltimore in August 1866, declared, you know, which indicates, you know, Marx is paying attention to this Congress held in Baltimore in 1866. The first and great necessity of the present is to free the labor of this country from capitalistic slavery. The careful distinction here between wage work and slavery is at the same time a simultaneity of modes. They're different, but they're not analytically separate. A complex ensemble structured in dominance. Chapter 10, the working day chapter, ends. I'll read the first line or two, which are obscured here to you, in a similar way. It must be acknowledged that our worker emerges from the process of production looking different from when he entered it. Sexist language advisory. In the market, as owner of the commodity labor power, he stood face to face with other owners of commodities, one owner against another. You sell your labor. The contract by which he sold his labor power to the capitalist proved in black and white, so to speak, that he was free to dispose of himself. But when the transaction was concluded, it was discovered that he was no free agent, that the period of time for which he is free to sell his labor power is the period of time for which he is forced to sell it, that in fact the vampire will not let go while there remains a single muscle, sinew, or drop of blood to be exploited, which he takes from Engels. So being sold into slavery. Okay, I'm getting close to my conclusion here. So what to do with all of this? My thinking was sort of reanimated or animated over time by an essay by historian Walter Johnson, an essay called The Pedestal and the Veil, which takes the terms of that epigraph that I read to you from Marx, the pedestal of sort of veiled slavery, or the pedestal of actual slavery in the United States, being the foundation of the veiled slavery of wage work in the UK. That's the way Marx puts it. Walter Johnson claims in this essay, The Pedestal and the Veil, I have a long reading of this essay, that's the way Marx leaves it. That Marx doesn't, because he's focused on linen, not cotton, England, not a world system, not the US, that Marx represses slavery from his analysis in Das Kapital. And I would agree with this in the sense that he doesn't theorize it as such, as part of the world system that he's trying to address. But I disagree completely because, as I'm trying to argue here, slavery shows up all over the place in Das Kapital, as metaphor, as actual fact, in the footnotes, in the text. Footnotes are great, you know, just kind of incredible. Now, it's true that there's a kind of foundational exclusion of slavery from the text, its restriction to that final section, section 8, on what Marx calls so-called primitive accumulation, or a better translation I'm given to understand might be originary accumulation. You know, Marx has this funny stuff in chapter, in section 8, not chapter 8. It's chapters, I think, 27 to 32, 33 to the very end, where he says, where did capital come from? Where did capitalism come from? You know, how did the transition occur from feudalism to capitalism? You know, standard conventional political economists will tell you that people just save their money. They're really good savers. And Marx is like, no, that's ridiculous. You know, they stole land they pushed peasants off the soil. They hunted down black people, Africans. They killed redskins. This is the language Marx uses. They hunted black skins and they put them to work. There's an original kind of violence that produces the capitalist system as such. But then capitalism starts, and you're sort of led to think, okay, that's an advance to see it as an extractive, violent period that led to the foundation of capitalism. But Marx leads you to believe that that was then, and this is now, capital. When and many others would argue that one has to see that primitive accumulation, originary accumulation, as ongoing and ever-present. That's why slavery can still exist. As he's writing Capital Volume, that's what slavery is primitive accumulation, unpaid labor that drives the entire system. And that's what historians like Ed Baptist and in a book called The Half of It Will Never Be Told, the work of Sven Beckerts and other historians are trying to show the way in which the slave system, far from being an autonomous mode of production or society, was in fact intricately tied in to capitalism. Johnson, in that essay, notes that the world system was an ensemble of capitalist and semi-capitalist systems knotted together, but himself claims about Marx that Marx, you mean, that's the end of the story, that Marx just can't deal with it. And I think the situation is more complicated than that. It is true, and this is where I'll sort of end, this is my final point, that it's complicated and muddy enough to note that when you get to that section 8, he at least accounts for the extractive process of primitive accumulation, but doesn't allow for the way it continues. And I think the reason for this is Texas, basically, what one might refer to metaphorically as Texas. That is territory, which he really can't account for the ongoing theft of within the pages of Das Kapital. It happened once upon a time, because that's kind of how it happened in England, you know, in the enclosure movement, and then it's sort of all over. There is no more land. But in the North American context, and that's why the Civil War was fought, as a matter of fact. We get into a war with Mexico, we steal a bunch of territory, and then immediately, rather than solving problems, it creates more problems because arguments begin about whether this new territory is going to be so-called free territory or slave territory. And that's essentially what leads to Civil War and revolution and the end of slavery. So Texas is more to the point than Marx would have thought or than he accounts for in Das Kapital. This is my last little bit. Marx will say here, for example, that modern industry in England has two pivots. One is cotton, one is the potato, in a piece on the British cotton trade. But he doesn't really fully account for the way cotton drives much of his story. He does try to think them together, but he can't really do it because territory is just kind of long ago and at the very end there in section 8. And this is where the shortcomings of Marx's rather provincial focus on Britain hobble the analysis. No colonies, no Mexican War, no cotton, and no accounting, really, for slavery. The chapter on the modern theory of colonization may close out the book, but it doesn't sufficiently inform what comes before it, because that is where the two systems, wage slavery and actual slavery, fight it out on American soil for dominance. So my final word then to you, and I'll close here, is there's no question to me that Marx accorded the U.S. Civil War and the slave system and all its products in many senses, all the way out to the theoretical, as important to his thinking about revolution and to the capitalist system as such. He just didn't do justice to it in ways that I hope to further explore. But it does make the U.S. case less an instance of the revolutionary set of developments he's talking about than a template for it as he talks about it in the British context. But thank you for listening. And I look forward to any questions you might have.
Thank you very much for that, Professor Watt. And I'm just going to abuse my chair for a second. When I was in Manchester, there's an Abraham Lincoln statue actually there to commemorate the solidarity between the workers who processed the cotton and the slaves. And they also sent a letter to Abraham Lincoln, as I recall. Also at the University of Edinburgh where I went, or in Edinburgh, there's also an Abraham Lincoln statue. So that means Constance needs to have an Abraham Lincoln statue because every university I'm associated with needs one nearby.
Very nice.